We're taking up in Shemos, one of the major themes is the way God relates to the Egyptians and specifically to Pharaoh. And the whole mission of Moshe Rabbeinu seems to be to convince Pharaoh to let the Jews go of his own accord, which is an interesting point that obviously God can remove the Jews. And God has the power to free the Jews from bondage and to destroy Pharaoh, to destroy Egypt, or to paralyze them, as we see throughout all the Makos, to afflict them in a manner that they couldn't really stop the Jews from leaving. As, for example, we see in the case of Choshech, the darkness, which was so thick that it says that the Egyptians couldn't move, basically. So pretty much they were paralyzed. And the question can be raised, why didn't the Jews just leave at that point in time? Well, could the Jews have left at that point in time? Nevertheless, that wasn't the objective. The objective was for Pharaoh to release the Jews. Shalach Hazami, send forth my nation. So it was the will of God that Pharaoh should release the Jews, and to do so of his own accord. And thus the question arises, why? What difference does it make how the Jews are removed from Egypt? Exodus. What difference does it make? If the entire point is that they should be released in order that they should serve God, become the people of God, receive the Torah, so why is it necessary to go through this entire procedure? And in any event, it seems that it didn't work anyways, that in spite of all of Moshe's requests, in spite of the plagues, the Makos, in spite of the fact that at times Pharaoh is ready to concede, but he always hardens his heart and changes his mind. And in the end, it's only because of the Makas Bechoros, the plague of the firstborn, which Pharaoh was unable to resist, apparently. So the first question is, why? Why not just take them out? That's the way a human would look at it. If representatives of an enslaved people, or those who care about them, had the power to remove them, they wouldn't go through all of this negotiation. They would just drop the bomb, whatever they had to do, or could do. So what's the reason for this? The whole dialogue with Moshe, the burning bush, and Rashi says that it was for 7 days, is all because Moshe really doesn't want to accept the mission. And God prevails upon him. It even says that God, so to speak, got angry at Moshe. And Moshe really had no choice. And then he had to appoint, God appointed Aharon to work with him. But what do we need all this for? Why is all this necessary? Moshe didn't want to do it because he said he's not qualified to play this kind of a role. But this kind of a role is only because, for whatever reason, it's the will of God that the release should come about through Paro. And therefore, you need someone who's going to bring him around to releasing them. But why was it necessary? They could have been freed from Egypt in a very simple kind of a way. All right, in order to answer this question, we're going to connect it to another question. And that is a theme that is expressed throughout the encounter between Moshe and Paro, is the issue of the hardening of the heart, that God hardens the heart of Paro. Or sometimes it says that he hardened his heart, that Paro hardened his own heart. And there's one position that maintains that in the first 5 plagues, Paro was left to his own devices. God did not affect him in any way. In the second 5, the expression that God hardened his heart implies that he was affected. The manner of his reaction was affected somehow or other by something that God caused to happen to him, which superficially gives the impression that God hardened his heart, made him stubborn, and therefore he refused. But that refusal was not an expression of his own volition. It wasn't something that came from his free will, but rather it was due to a hardness, a stubbornness that had been engendered by God. Of course, this raises many questions, because then it would seem to be contradictory. What's the point of asking somebody, trying to persuade somebody to do something, ostensibly out of his own volition, and then making it impossible for him to do that which you want him to do? So this is a big problem with the whole issue of free will. Now, the Sforno has a very fascinating answer. So we're going to Parshas Va'era. That's Shemos, chapter 7, where God is instructing Moshe. And he tells him that he's explaining to Moshe the arrangement between him and Aaron, the manner in which they'll present themselves. That you will speak everything that I command you, that the Nevuah, the prophecy, would come from God to Moshe, and Moshe would give it over to Aaron. Aaron would be the spokesman. That is in accordance with the request of Moshe, that Moshe Rabbeinu said that he was kvad peh, that he was not a good speaker. He didn't have the ability to persuade people verbally. That seems to be the major objection that Moshe had towards assuming the leadership. So therefore, God appointed Aaron to perform that role. He would be, so to speak, like an interpreter. V'shilach es b'nei Yisrael me'arzo, to send the Jews from his land. V'ani akshes leiv paro. So God is revealing to him something that's going to happen. I will harden the heart of Paro. V'irbesi es ososai, and I will increase my signs, vias mofsai, and wonders in the land of Mitzrayim. And then again, v'lo yishma lechem paro. Paro will not listen to you. V'nasati es yodi b'Mitzrayim, I will stretch my hand against Egypt. V'otesi es tzivosai, and I'll remove from there my hosts, as ami b'nei Yisrael, my nation, the children of Israel from the land of Egypt, b'shvatim gedolim, with great the justices, with great ordinances, judgments, with great judgments. V'yodu Mitzrayim kini Hashem, and Egypt will know that I am God. V'ntosi es yodi al Mitzrayim, when I stretch forth my hand over Egypt, and I take out b'nei Yisrael mitocham, the b'nei Yisrael from their midst. Well, first of all, you see from this that it wasn't as simplistic as we said before, that there were many purposes over here. We can't look at this purely from the perspective of ourselves, from a subjective perspective. The natural attitude of most Jews who read the story is that everything revolves around the Jews. And the Egyptians are just a bothersome influence, a player in the story, but they're just a force that has to be removed, dealt with, just get them out of our way. They have no real significance other than the fact that they're blocking our exodus. But here we see that from the divine perspective, it wasn't that simplistic. Indeed, the objective was to remove the Jews, my nation. But in doing so, God wanted to effectuate a change in the Egyptians. The Yadu Mitzrayim Kani Roshem, that the Egyptians should know that I am God. That's a very important theme in the story. And it's important for us to realize that the Jewish people, the whole objective, the whole purpose of the Jewish people is not just for the Jewish people. It's not a self-contained phenomenon. And many people have this attitude that the whole world revolves around Jewish existence, and anything outside of Jewish existence is not true existence. It's no significance. There are many Jews that have such an attitude. But here we see that it's not the case from the perspective of God. All of mankind is included in the divine plan, that all of mankind should recognize HaKadosh Baruch Hu, first and foremost, should recognize the true Creator. And when God relates to the world, He does so for that purpose. The Jews have a very significant role to play in that objective, that they are the ones who are supposed to be the teachers of these truths to mankind. But in the very act of relating to the Jews, the rest of the world is not excluded. So that was the reason why Moshe was sent. The whole point was to facilitate that the Egyptians, Paro, because he's the ruler, and his servants, and through them, the entire people would come to recognize the truth, and when they recognized this truth, then there'd be no problem of the enslavement. They would set the Jews free, but that would be the greatest thing for them as well. That's why, if you take a look at the development of the story, it goes in stages. That the Makos don't come immediately. First, Moshe goes to Paro without any signs and communicates ideas to him. The ideas about God, the creator of the universe, divine providence, the relationship to the Jewish people, and the fact that God, it's God's will that you free the Jews. So he's talking to Paro in the framework of what Paro ought to do in terms of God's will. In fact, he doesn't even make it a point that it's wrong, it's for our sake, you have no right to enslave us. He doesn't take that approach. The approach is, this is contrary to the will of God. And it's in your interests to act in terms of the will of God. So that's in the first encounter, the truth of the matter is it made things worse in the short run. Because Paro decided to thwart Moshe by increasing the workload, and thereby causing the Jews to turn against Moshe. That they would say, he's made things worse for us. And they'd give up on this whole idea. They'd lose hope. But, nevertheless, God says that when Paro speaks to you, he's going to request proof from you. It did evoke something in Paro. You see that. And you see that there was a relationship between Moshe and Paro. And you see at certain points that Paro acknowledges that he's guilty, he's wrong, and God is righteous. So there was a process over there. And then he performs the sign with the serpents. The casting of the staff, and it turns into a serpent. I wrote a short essay on this, specifically with regard to the first of the osos of the signs. Basing myself on the question that it seems that the Egyptians were pretty much able to duplicate it. And indeed, the miracle of Moshe was greater. In fact, what the Egyptians did was not a miracle, it was magic, sleight of hand. But nevertheless, it seems that that was enough to provide Paro with the rationalization to deny the miracle of Moshe Rabbeinu. Our guys did the same thing, pretty much. So my question was, why wouldn't God give Moshe something that can't be duplicated? And the answer that I gave there was that this is precisely the point, that the objective of the encounter with Paro was for the benefit of Paro and Mitzrayim, that they should come to a genuine realization of the truth. That's the greatest thing, not just that they should give in because they've been overwhelmed, but to the greatest extent possible is through the utilization of the mind. And therefore, the miracle itself, the very need for a miracle makes things worse, because it's better if you do it purely because of the logic of the situation, purely because of rationality. That's why at first Moshe came without any demonstrations, just with ideas. That's the greatest expression of man's ability to choose to see the truth. There's no need for signs. When, however, Paro refused, so then God gave him a sign. But there too, it's pretty much minimalistic, just enough to be able to use your mind. An intelligent person would have, if he was able to put his emotions aside and he really was interested in the truth, he would have seen the truth. When that failed, so the next phase is the Makos. Now, in my opinion, the Makos, however, should not be construed as punishments. That's a mistake. There's many other proofs for that, which I can't go into right now. But the Makos is really a continuation of the signs, except they're of a different kind. Because since the Egyptians had resistance, and they were manifesting an indifference, they found a way to ignore the significance of the signs, so then something was needed to focus their attention. And this time the sign was something which afflicted them. And you see that same process. The first Makos were much milder. But it's not just a question that we start off with mildness, then we'll get tougher with you. There's a reason for it. For example, the first one, the Dam, that the waters of the Nile turn into blood and are useless. So it says that Paro turned away. He went back to his house. So it's something which grabs your attention because you have to deal with it. It's happening to your country, but it's something which you can also turn away from. The next one, he couldn't turn away from. The Pasuk describes by the Tzfardim. It was in his house, it was in his bed, and so forth. The idea being that there was no escape. But not that you should be in such a state of pain that you should be unable, you're forced into submission. It was never the objective to force into submission. And that explains another idea, because I pointed out that in many cases when Paro can't take it anymore and he calls for Moshe and he wants to do anything to bring an end to the plague, so then Moshe immediately grants him what he wants. He says, okay, tell me when. When do you want it stopped? And then Moshe leaves and he prays and he removes the plague. And then Paro changes his mind. So the question that I always asked was that it seems that this is not a smart way to negotiate. It seems. Now why would you be so kind? Why are you giving in before Paro releases anybody? You have leverage here. Why didn't Moshe tell him, start releasing the Jews? When you release the Jews, or when you've released a certain amount of Jews, so that I'm convinced that you're sincere. Well, he trusts him all the time, and this happens many, many times. Oh, but he doesn't seem to learn this lesson, Moshe Rabbeinu. That Paro can't be trusted. And that the next time, don't agree to remove the plague. Because once you remove the plague, he has no incentive anymore. It's interesting to note that this was Moshe's decision. That even though it seems that Moshe is carrying out every instruction from God, which he is carrying out every instruction, but still there was a mission. Moshe had to use his own devices, his own intelligence. It wasn't as though every move is scripted. Indeed, if that were the case, then it would be hard to understand. Why does Moshe say, I'm not suited for the mission? If you really don't have to do anything, I'm sort of, so to speak, putting you in the control tower of a satellite or whatever it is. So my answer would be, I'm not suited, I'm not qualified. But then if someone says, no, everything is worked out very clearly with numbers, and I will merely tell you what to push and when to push it. And therefore, it's not going to require any kind of understanding on your part. You will just carry out the orders, and they're very simple orders. So then I can't complain anymore. What's my complaint? It doesn't require any qualification. That doesn't seem to be the answer that God gives him. It does require qualification. So certain aspects of it will be purely from God. That's true. But then there's other aspects where Moshe has to exercise judgment. Thus, when Paro asked him to bring him relief from the frogs, at that point in time, it doesn't seem that God told him to just go ahead and guarantee it. Well, God didn't instruct him to do it the other way. That was Moshe's decision. It seems obvious that that's the case, because Moshe then goes and he prays to God that God would stop it. But if God told him he's going to stop it, so why does Moshe have to pray that he would stop it? It seems that Moshe made the decision. This is the correct thing to do. And then he prays to God that God will cause it to happen in accordance with the decision of Moshe. But that idea that he would not demand that Paro release the Jews first, that seems to be Moshe's decision and not God telling him what to do. In subsequent cases, when the same thing happens, and Paro can take the pain of the Makos, and he calls to Moshe to bring an end, Moshe never says, I made a mistake the first time, I trusted you, this time I'm not going to trust you. He never changes that. And that's a really difficult question to address. Why would that be? Any negotiator would learn. The question gets a little bit more complicated. Because if we're going to say that it wasn't the case that God simply wanted Paro to release the Jews, but only to do so as a result of his free will, because he recognized that that was the right thing to do. So then on the other hand, in this situation, it seems that the reason why Paro was willing, at least, when he expresses a willingness to do so, is only because of the pain. The pain becomes unbearable. So how do you square that? If the pain is unbearable, so then it's not free will. That's precisely the answer, though. That's the reason why Moshe Rabbeinu, even though he probably could have succeeded. When Paro is under the pain of the plague, he's experiencing it, and he just wants to get rid of the pain, and he's willing to let the Jews go. At that point, had Moshe demanded that first let the Jews go, then I'll remove the plague. I will not remove it until you let them go, or at least you make sufficient moves to give me assurance that you're not going to rescind. He probably would have succeeded had Moshe acted that way, and he could have had the Jews released at that point. Thus, one asks, well, why not do that? Why keep the agony going? The answer, in my opinion, has to do with the basic premise that all of this was an opportunity for the Egyptians, that's how God relates to mankind, that it's the will of God that mankind uses its free will. The whole theme of the Torah, and specifically in this particular story, is free will. That it is only of value if it is done. If man does the appropriate thing, it's only of value if he does it as a result of his free will. That's the fundamental of human perfection. It's all based upon free will. And that if a person does something out of coercion, to the extent that it's lacking in his own choice, he's not perfected by it. He's perfected by it because he chose it, and he implements it. He's acting in accordance with the good. It's an internalization of the good. And that's why it's true that Paro had deviated, and that Paro needed certain things to be brought back to his senses. So that's true of all of us, that from sufferings, as a result of sufferings, it wisens us up, because that's our nature. We get caught up in fantasy. And then when we suffer tragedies, disappointments, and we're shaken for a moment out of the fantasy. For example, now the entire world is consumed with what happens with the tsunamis and the devastation. And people are shocked by this. Of course, it's a tragedy, but it has the possibility of leading people to some kind of reality, that the sense is that they've been living in a dreamland, with a false sense of security and a false idea as to what they should be doing, pursuing emptiness and vanity. And the idea that within a few seconds everything can be gone shocks people, and perhaps they will start to reconsider what the purpose of life is. Why weren't they thinking about that to begin with? Well, that's human nature. And God takes that into consideration and gives us many, many opportunities through suffering. The suffering very often in life has unintended positive consequences. As a result of suffering, people are forced to reevaluate. Now, when they're forced to reevaluate, they're using their mind. And they're using the mechanisms of freedom, of volition, of free choice. The fact that it only came about as a result of suffering indicates it may not mean that they weren't on the highest level. That's true, but it's still of value. And that, I think, is the idea over here. That that Moshe understood this. Moshe recognized what the objective was. That the objective was not to beat him into submission and to coerce him by the pain of the experiences. But rather, the pain was necessary because once he reached that level where he was simply rationalizing, he was in denial, he was negating what was going on. So then the pain had to be such that he couldn't avoid it. But had Moshe Rabbeinu demanded that he let the Jews go then, while he was under the force of the pain, then it would not have achieved this objective. Indeed, he might have let them go, but then that would have been a failure. The objective was, that's what Moshe said, that you tell me when. He gave him the opportunity to pick out the time, and I will do so. And then, once the plague is removed, and you're no longer under the gun, then you have to think it over. You have to sit down and think it over and internalize, what did I learn from this? What are the implications of this? Is it something that was just an accident and I felt the pain, that's why I agreed? Or no, I could see from this the universals, I could see the big truth, the big picture. That's the true test. When a person experiences a calamity, there's the momentary reaction, the reaction of the moment. And that's what they refer to as the foxhole conversion. It's a term that's used, you know, in the culture at large. And that means a soldier or anybody when they're in a situation of great danger. People who've been stranded in situations where they didn't think they could survive. And they sort of pray to God. And many people weren't even religious, but due to the emotions of the moment, they call out to a higher power. And they make all kinds of agreements, promises. If God will only save me, I'll do such and such. And then let's assume that they're saved. The immediate response is that, of course, I'm going to change my whole life now. And people often say this when they have diseases and they experience what they regard as a miraculous cure. But then the question is, do they really change their life? It's no indication what they say at that moment, because at that moment, they're not speaking from that part of the mind which is going to be making the decisions. It hasn't been internalized. We need to see what happens after the emotions of the moment wear off. Very often people go back to their old habits. They go back to their old ways, and they sort of deny. They deny it. They forget because they never internalized the lesson. So it's just an emotion of the moment. And that's no significant change. That's why Moshe Rabbeinu told him on all the occasions, okay, if this is how you feel, you're prepared to let the Jews go, fine, I'll bring the plague to an end. But then we'll see what happens afterwards. I'm not going to demand that you let the Jews go now, because if you did that, that wouldn't prove anything. It's not at the point where it could be considered free will. You're just reacting to pressure. I will remove the pressure. And then, once the pressure is removed, you're going to think it over again. And all the old emotions are going to reassert themselves. And then you'll have a real conflict. Will you find some way to rationalize? You saw. Your mind should say, what's the difference how I feel? But look what I saw. The evidence of the mind. This is permanent. This is immutable. What difference does it make that now things have gone back to normal? Or, once the pain is gone, will you find some way to rationalize it, to dilute it, and simply decide to continue on the old path of living in accordance with your own personal desires and fantasies and your own distorted viewpoint? That's why Moshe acts that way. Because the ultimate objective was that the Egyptians should come around to a proper recognition of the truth, And on that basis, they should recognize God and let the Jews go because it's the will of God. That would be the greatest blessing for the Egyptians as well. Now, we can turn to the Sforno, which we started out with, on that troubling verse, which says that I will harden the heart of Paro, which is an even bigger question in light of what we've just said. That if the objective is that he should leave, let the Jews go out of free will, so what is the meaning that I will harden his heart? Now, the Sforno, on chapter 7, verse 3, so he says that since God desires the repentance of the wicked, v'lo b'misasam, and not their death, which implies that if they remain wicked, then they're simply subject for death. And he quotes many psukim, Chai Hashem, by the life of God, Noam, God says, do I desire the death? I don't desire the death of the wicked. Kiyim b'shuva rashim idarko v'chaya. It's a quotation from Yecheskel. That all God wants is the return of the Rasha from his path that he live. So therefore, he explains what God said to Moshe, that he would increase the signs and the wonders. And that is, the purpose was to bring the Egyptians back with tshuva. God, so to speak, cares for the Egyptians, that they should do tshuva. So that's something we have to take to heart, that God is concerned about all of mankind. In that God would make known to them his power and his compassion through the signs and the wonders. And he quotes other psukim to this that are interspersed throughout the parshios. Bavur zos hamaraticha, bavur haroschas kochi. It's because of this that I established you in order to show you my power, to recognize God. And in addition, part of the intention was that the Jews should learn. They should see and they should fear. So there were two objectives. We've mentioned one, that it's clearly for the sake of the Jewish people too. They too needed reinforcement. As it says, Laman Tesaper, that the Jews should tell it, what they saw here, to their children and children's children. Then he says something fascinating. There's no doubt that were it not for the hardening of the heart of Paro, of course he would have sent the Jews out. But not because of tshuva, of repentance, and humbling himself before God, that he would repent from being rebellious, even though he recognized his greatness and his power, but rather it would be because he could no longer bear the pain of the Makos. As we see, his servants later on tell him, Hataram Teda, Ki Avda Mitzrayim, don't you know already that we're lost? And the Sforno says, that's not tshuva. When the servants urge Paro to let the Jews go, and they say, isn't it clear already that Egypt is lost? That's not an expression of tshuva. That's self-interest. You're just giving in to a force which you can't do anything about. You want to avoid destruction. But that's not a genuine recognition. Thus, he says, had Paro desired to humble himself to God before God, to subordinate himself to God, and to return with complete teshuva, there would have been nothing holding him back. See, the Sforno learns differently than the Rambam. The Sforno is not learning that God was taking away his bechira. To the contrary, at all points in time, he had the bechira. He had the power of free choice to recognize God and to humble himself before God. And nothing would have stopped him from that. And God said that I will harden the heart of Paro. What does that mean that God said he would harden the heart of Paro? He's saying that it's to the contrary, that the hardening of the heart was essential to facilitate, to preserve the capacity for free choice. Which means that he'll have the strength to endure the Makos. And he would not send them because of the fear of the Makos. And that's what it says, Laman Shisi Ososai Ela Bekirbo, in order to place my signs among them, from them he would recognize God's greatness and goodness. And the Egyptians would return with a true tshuva. You could read the rest of the Sforno on your own, but that's the basic idea. The way I understand it is that there had to be a certain type of a balance. As we said before, the fact that a person makes life-changing decisions only because he suffered some setbacks, only because he suffered some pain, that does not mean to say that it's not a genuine tshuva experience. It's not a genuine choice of the good. It is a genuine choice of the good. It may not be on the highest level, because the highest level would be that the person does so purely because of his understanding of reality. Here, it's only because he suffered a setback. It doesn't matter, though. The suffering of the setback is a catalyst that gets the mind working. And once the mind works, then it makes a choice. However, in order for this to work, if you're going to subject someone to certain types of experiences, certain types of pains, then there's got to be a balance. If it's too painful, if it's too overwhelming, if it's too scary, so then you'll get what you want. The person will submit, but he won't have any freedom to do so. Indeed, that's what happens with the Makas Bechoros. The Makas Bechoros, the slaying of the firstborn, that was a punishment. In that moment, Paro really had no free choice. The pain was too great. However, with regard to the other ones, as long as Paro was still deserving of having an opportunity to do tshuva, at a certain point in time, it becomes too late. God gave them every opportunity. But that doesn't last forever. Comes a point in time where that's it. You've used up your chances. And now God is going to get the Jews out of Egypt in a different way. However, in order for these makos, the makos are now going to be increasing in intensity. So you can have a problem, because the increase in intensity precludes the possibility of freedom. It's too painful, too scary. So what God is telling Moshe is that this too is going to be a miracle, that God will affect the heart of Paro, the heart over here meaning the emotions of Paro, so that he will experience the pain of these plagues, but it won't overwhelm him. He'll give him a certain type of an emotional endurance and strength so that he can withstand what the ordinary person would cave into. He will not be destroyed emotionally, and he'll still retain the capacity to relate to them in the framework of free will. That is, after the plagues are removed, he will not be like a traumatized person. A traumatized person would have no choice. He'd just say, let the Jews go. I can't deal with this. So I will harden his heart means, to the contrary, that I will give him a certain emotional endurance so that he will not be traumatized by these makos, so that he can experience the pain of the maka and learn the lesson of the maka, but still, after it's gone, retain the capacity to return and to think it over, and to still have the opportunity to make a choice. That is, the ability to make the choice to continue in his instinctual path, to go back, to revert to the path of living in accordance with his desires, will not be ruled out because the pain, the trauma of what he's experienced is so great that it's impossible for him to go back. He must at all points in time retain the possibility to go both ways. That's what free will is. If a person doesn't have the capacity to go one way, and then he certainly, a person has no capacity to do a certain sin for whatever reason, physically, emotionally, and thus he chooses a different course. That's not a choice. He didn't choose a different course. There was no choice. He had to do it. Now, many, many times in a person's life, that's the case. He doesn't have any choice. If you pose certain threats before a person, if you do such and such, or if you don't do such and such, If you don't do what I command you to do, I'm going to torture your children in front of your own eyes, whatever the case may be. So the person does it. That doesn't mean he chose. What choice did he have? The alternative is so unbearable, so intolerable, that he was forced to do it. He was compelled. That's the idea of Ani Aksha, that Paro will not be under that kind of a compulsion. And I will see to it. I will affect his emotional state in such a way that he'll still retain a certain type of emotional strength, not to be cowered by the force, not to be traumatized by the force of the plague, so that indeed he will retain the capability of free will. So from this we see how significant this is, that this is the ultimate objective of the creation, that man should recognize the good and do so purely out of free will, but not because he's cowered into doing so. That's the way the Sephardo explains that verse, which on the surface seems to be contrary to free will, but the Sephardo explains that no, it's actually to sustain the capability of free will.